This is Fresh Air. William Kittredge is from a pioneering family that helped change the American West, only to be changed by it. His family owned a huge ranch, which has been described as the family's blessing and curse. William Kittredge was the third and last generation to live on it. He doesn't own any land, but the changing American West has become the subject of his fiction and essays. His latest book is a memoir about growing up in the West called Hole in the Sky. He told me how his family first acquired their land in eastern Oregon.
My grandfather got, in 1911, he got around 4,000 acres, I think, at the northern end of Summer Lake. In 1916, he began to amass what eventually added up to about 16,000 acres on the Klamath Marsh. And then in the mid-1930s, during the Great Depression, he picked up essentially no money down and a handshake almost, pay me later when you see me, the MC Ranch in Warner Valley, which was about 21 or 22,000 acres of irrigated land and a huge BLM allotment, around 1 million acres. Sometimes I think in the early days it was larger than that, about 1.25 million, I think. In any event, it was a huge property, and 50 miles from one end to the other that the MC was, and we had other properties in California and so forth. My grandfather really believed that somehow he was putting together an empire in a way that would last forever. I think it actually lasted about 9 years after his death. I think he thought the family would hold this together forever. And we, of course, didn't.
When did he die?
1958.
And why didn't the family hold it together?
Well, it was a matter of the ways in which power passed along, kind of aspirations in the family, the things my grandfather wanted. He really believed that everybody in the family should put money first, put property first, put the welfare of the property first, put the money-making power of the property first, before happiness, before your marriage, before the prospects for your children, before whatever. That those things came first, and a great many people, in various kinds of situations, decided they didn't want to do that. And every time they didn't, he was furious and felt like they had betrayed him. Eventually, that kind of thinking, in which essentially. Love takes the hind seat, family takes the hind seat in a way, led to all kinds of hate and discontent inside the family, and made any kind of coherent feeling of togetherness in the family absolutely impossible.
What was your father's attitude toward the land that your grandfather brought? I'm sure your father was expected to be somebody who took as good care of it as your grandfather did, and who passed it on to you, the next generation.
He didn't want to go back to the land. Essentially, he got out of college, Oregon State College, in the 20s, and he wanted to go off and be a lawyer. He had all kinds of other aspirations. My grandfather spent all one day talking him into coming home, staying home, taking care of the property, being on the property, doing what the oldest son should do, the only son should do. And my father, was won over. He did it. And I think he regretted it all his life, and eventually that led to great trouble between the two of them. He was supposed to come home and be the proper heir, the one who built on the beginnings my grandfather had made, the one who put it all together. And for a while he did that. When we got the property in Warner in 1935, 1936, 1937, and through the 40s, he managed the farming in Warner Valley and in very innovative ways. He drained about 8,000 or 9,000 acres of swampland, farmed it, put it into alfalfa. He was a remarkable leader, a remarkable innovator in that time. But all the time, he was always harboring this resentment that he had not actually wanted to do this. And eventually, and doing things, he made some good money in the process. For a few years there, and he spent it in rather frivolous ways. As my mother said, he was ahead of his time in finding ways to spend his money. And my grandfather resented that. He resented the fact that my father knew movie actors and bought racehorses, all that kind of crazy stuff that my father loved to do. My grandfather thought was just insane. All that should be plowed back into the property. And my father didn't do it. In part, I think, out of resentment for my grandfather, out of resentment for the fact that his life had been, in a sense, he'd been talked out of his life, in a sense, which was, you know, his own fault. He should have allowed that to happen to him, so my father shouldn't.
Now, what about you? What was it like growing up and thinking of this huge expanse of land as being yours or your family's?
It wasn't something that ever really much occurred to you. I mean, it occurred to you. You knew how you were fortunate in a way. You knew that the few other people you knew, there weren't many other people out in that country, you know, some families, probably 20, 30 families. You knew they didn't have it. They had their own ranches. They were smaller. You felt somehow, without ever knowing why, that you were entitled to it. I'm talking about when I was a child, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. But we went to the same schools with those kids, and you know, we played games with them. We didn't feel any different from them. And one of the codes in my family was that we better not act like we were any different or any, you know, somehow more privileged than those kids were. There were no privileges in the sense in my family. I mean, nobody had fancy cars until my father kind of rebelled against all that stuff. But essentially, everybody lived common, lived plain, and did what my grandfather said, which was put things back into the property. So we felt somehow that for a long time, believing what my grandfather said, that somehow this was proper. We had earned this. We were humble people. We were good people. We were doing God's work. We were making, you know, making the world right. We were creating order in the world. And I think so many people in the American West believe that in one way or another to this day. And that accounts for in fact, a lot of the anger and a lot of sense of betrayal that's everywhere in the West today, as we see some of the traditional businesses, some of the traditional ways of making a living pass out of being or really pass into hard times, like agriculture and logging and mining.
Do you think the people who believe that were right in believing it?
They, you know, it's a dream of America. It's a dream, you know, people came here. America was possibility. America was you know, the kind of brave new world, and at the same time, America was wilderness, and America, it seemed to them, it was wilderness. It's astonishing that you know, the white folks from Europe came to a continent which had been populated, you know, essentially forever by people who didn't ruin it, and came here and looked at it and assumed it was wilderness. You know, they called it wilderness. It was some terrible, frightening place, and it had to be controlled. It had to be brought to order. It had to be, you know, brought into some kind of alignment that people could understand as orderly. And so we did just what my family did. We built fences. We, you know, we dug ditches. We ordered the watersheds. We plowed. We did all that stuff. We created croplands. Those croplands were essentially planted into one kind of monoculture or another. We got rid of natural diversity. We killed off the coyotes. We killed all kinds of animals. Just got rid of them, you know. All that is you know, has been devastating to the continent. It's been devastating to our culture. It's very devastating to people in the American West now who are as the impetus of that stuff begins to be looked at very closely and criticized a lot. They feel that somehow we're betraying them. That we're you know, the great dream that they believed of in the great dream they believed in. Of creating order in the world, which is what we thought we were doing, somehow turns out to not be the right idea. Somehow turns out to be a bad idea.
William Kittredge is my guest. He's written a new memoir called Hole in the Sky. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer William Kittredge. His new book is a memoir called Hole in the Sky. How many times did you leave and return to the ranch before leaving it for good?
Well,
did you do that a lot?
Oh, yeah, various times. Never with the idea of actually leaving forever. I went away to college, and about my junior year at Oregon State, I discovered books and ideas and kind of fell in love with them. And I took class from Bernard Malamud, and, you know, he hooked me on the idea that maybe I'd someday be a writer. And so I always walked, and then I went in the Air Force, and I tried to write while I was in the Air Force. Actually tried to publish two or three things. I think they were laughably bad. Went back to the ranch after I got out of the Air Force. I was 24, 25, and went back to work, you know, doing what I was supposed to do in a sense, entirely too either dim-witted or afraid of the world, one or the other, to go out and try it as try to learn how to be a writer, try to learn how to do all these things I had somehow been caught up with, you know, the notions of, and stayed on the ranch for 10 years, and finally, in 1967, when family dismay and upset and unrest finally came to a head, and we managed to sell the ranch. I went back to Iowa into the Iowa Writers' Workshop and got an MFA, and decided I'd make a life for myself as a writer. My father supported me in that enormously. All the way, I'm sure it sounded very crazy to him, but he said, I don't blame you. I spent all my life doing things I hated, and I sure wouldn't recommend that.
You know, it strikes me, although you don't have the land, you don't own the land the way your grandfather did,
mm-hmm.
but the land is yours as a writer. You write about the land. I mean, you have it, but you have it in a different way.
I think so. You know, I think that you don't need to have, physical ownership of a lot of things in the world if you have some kind of emotional connection to them. I always say, in a way you have a kind of emotional ownership. I go back to Warner Valley every year or two, sometimes a couple of times a year. It's fine. I look at it. People have taken care of it. It looks good to me. They're doing the best they can. There are a lot of practices that I'd like to see stopped now as time goes by. But on the other hand, it's not being devastated in any particular kind of way. And out on the high deserts, the part that I really love the most anymore, I suppose, everything is it's very timeless out there, and it's very much the way things have been. And I don't need to own that.
So when your family did sell out in the 60s, did you get a lot of money from that?
We got quite a bit, yes. I think it was, my share, which wasn't a big share, was about $350,000, some of which I had committed to various foolishnesses before I ever got it, and the rest of which, and then I got a divorce at almost exactly the same time and split the money and managed to go through every bit that I had in short order. I don't know why I did that psychically. Perhaps I don't know. It was just like a sense of freedom. I'd made my getaway, and now I suddenly had some spending money for a little while. And the only thing I did with it was of any use to anybody was I had the wit to get myself through the MFA program at Iowa and get myself a job at Montana before I really ran out of spending money. I got rid of it pretty fast, and I'm happy to say right now that anything I've got at the moment, I think I earned for myself.
Did you want to sever your ties in a way to the kind of Western aristocracy that your family had come to represent?
Yeah, I think probably that's so. I don't think I really had that in the front of my mind, but I think I certainly ran as fast as I could go, and I got rid of the money, and I felt like I cleaned up my act in some kind of way, and I found an entirely different kind of friends, and I've never gone back. I travel to Eastern Oregon now, and I always get up early in the morning, and I go down a little cafes and little towns, Burns and Lakeview and places like that, and sit in there at 6 o'clock in the morning and have some bacon and eggs, and it fills up with men that I might have been. And I look at those men and I watch them and I think, well, this is what I could have been. There's the man I could have been. And I don't feel any great sense of triumph or something that I didn't become that man. I'm glad that I'm not, in a sense. I'm glad I don't live out there anymore. And there are lots of things about it that I didn't like. It was boring in lots of times, but on the other hand, I guess the thing that I really feel is that I have changed my life completely, and I'm happy that I'm not that person. But I always wonder, in a quite profound way, I think, what I missed by not being that person.
Yeah, I want to get back to something you were saying before. You were saying that you realized you didn't have to own property
mm-hmm.
to love it and to appreciate it. But there's times I know I've passed through a really beautiful place that had a really big sign on it saying private property, keep off.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you have a sense of, that all beauty is not accessible to you. How frustrated are you when you come across land like that?
Well, I'm frustrated by that. When I say that you don't have to own property for it to be, be part of you and so forth, it really helps if everybody else would play the game the same way.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course they don't. And I think that one of the things, one of the kinds of contracts we're going to have to enter into more and more in the American West is that in some way there's going to have to be public properties that are going to have to not be sold and not be fenced off for the exclusive use of a few apparently wealthy people. And it is very frustrating to it's happening all over the West. It's a great cause of rage and discouragement in working-class communities in the American West, for instance, in various areas in Montana, where the best land has been brought up and essentially fenced off and is no longer available to them. The working-class people, the people who can't afford to buy land like that, are profoundly angered by that and profoundly upset by it. And it's the sort of thing you'll hear talked about over and over again in the barbershop, for instance. Those are issues that really touch people at the heart.
You don't own any land now. Do you own your house?
Not a square inch. No, I live in an apartment.
Do you own that?
I live in an apartment in Missoula, which is just fine with me. Of course, I cheat, I guess, in a sense. For a long time, I've lived with a woman named Onyx Smith who owns 160 acres about 30 miles out of Missoula, and I go out there 3 or 4 days of the week, and it's beautiful property, and enjoy hers, so I'm probably cheating a little bit, too.
That does sound like you're cheating.
Not very much, no.
You kind of have the best of both worlds, no responsibility to the property, but you've got land to go to.
Yeah, I feel that way, so that's why I say I'm cheating a little bit.
William Kittredge, he's the author of the new memoir, Hole in the Sky. He lives in Missoula, Montana. This is Fresh Air.